ExxonMobil became alarmed enough to start lobbying directly in state capitals.
"The one lobbyist we did hear from was from ExxonMobil," recalled Virginia Lyons, a biologist and legislator who sponsored Vermont's ban. ExxonMobil's local advocate stirred up the fishing and hunting community by saying if phthalates were banned in the state of Vermont, then fishing would be affected because lures were made of soft plastics. In fact, the Vermont bill did not address fishing lures at all, only toys. Lyons finally outflanked the ExxonMobil lobby by adding to the final version of the bill a line declaring that nothing in the new law should be construed to regulate firearms, hunting, or fishing equipment. In Hartford, Connecticut, chemical industry lobbyists walked through the state house with Gumby toys in their pockets. They would grab a lawmaker, pull out the toy, and declare ominously, "They're going to ban Gumby." The wave of phthalate regulation at last rolled into Washington in 2008. Breast Cancer Fund lobbyists briefed U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein about the issue, noting the San Francisco ban already enacted and the similar bill passed by the California legislature, which awaited action by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Senator Feinstein saw an opening to advance the cause in Congress. She owed that opportunity to unscrupulous toy makers in China. In 2007, Mattel Incorporated had recalled 967,000 toys, an Elmo tub sub, a Dora the Explorer backpack, and Giggle Gabbers shaped like Sesame Street's Cookie Monster and Elmo among them, because the toys contained lead paint. China increasingly was the source of the toys America's children played with. The Mattel recall was just one in a series of revelations about the shoddy quality of some Chinese toy manufacturing. China bashing and child safety being two of the less controversial subjects in American politics, federal lawmakers scrambled to introduce bills that would tighten standards for the toys that American children enjoyed. As a Senate version of this toy safety bill glided toward passage early in 2008, California's two senators, Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, slipped in a floor amendment that incorporated a version of the European Union's phthalate regulation, one that would prevent American children from putting DINP-laden vinyl ducks into their mouths. The bill passed easily. It was not clear whether ExxonMobil's Washington office even understood what had happened until it was too late. The U.S. House of Representatives, now controlled by Democrats, also passed a companion toy safety bill. It became known as the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008. The House version, however, did not address the phthalates question at all. The matter would be decided in a conference committee organized to reconcile the two bills for final passage. President Bush was unlikely to veto legislation designed to keep American children safe from faulty Chinese toys, so by the spring of 2008, it seemed clear that a final law would indeed be written, passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the President. The question that mattered to ExxonMobil Chemical was whether that bill would ban DINP from toys. ExxonMobil and public health lobbyists had been battling one another inconclusively over phthalates for a decade. The corporation's scientists had prevailed in the technocratic, relatively closed forum of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Congress was a different venue, one that favored the public interest groups. Anticipating an intense summer of lobbying and public relations struggle, the advocates at the Washington, D.C. offices of the Public Interest Research Group reached deep into their bag of advocacy tricks. They manufactured a 25-foot-high inflatable rubber duck. They then carted the giant duck to Capitol Hill to call attention to their sign-waving street demonstrations in favor of a DINP ban. In addition to the big duck, ExxonMobil's interest in the legislation was identified early on as an element of the public interest group's lobbying strategy. Noted Liz Hitchcock, one of the campaigners, "They're the perfect villain." Joe Barton, the Republican congressman who represented Texas's 6th District, which lay just to the south of Dallas, bore a resemblance to Rex Tillerson, both in appearance and by his biography. Barton had been born in Waco, Texas in 1949, 3 years before Tillerson's birth in Wichita Falls, 200 miles away. Now in his late 50s, Barton combed his full head of silver hair in a style similar to that favored by ExxonMobil's leader. His face was similarly fleshy but fit-looking. Barton's political creed had been derived from the same rural ethos that had shaped Tillerson's rise, a synthesis of Christianity, small-town values, and faith in free markets. A sign in Joe Barton's Capitol Hill office reads, "Trust God. Tell the truth. Make a profit." Barton had studied industrial engineering at Texas A&M University on a scholarship, then earned a master's degree in industrial administration from Purdue University. He worked in business for a decade and served as a consultant on gas deregulation issues for Atlantic Richfield Company, the large oil and gas company eventually absorbed by BP. By 1984, Barton was an earnest man of 35 who had a strong desire to go to Congress and negligible prospects of getting there, as Mark Halperin and John F. Harris later wrote in their book, The Way to Win. But Joe Barton then made an excellent decision. He hired an Austin political consultant named Carl Rove to handle his direct mail as he challenged a better-known and better-funded opponent, Max Hoyt, in the Texas 6th Republican primary. Rove crafted mailers touting Barton as a proven cost-cutter who was educated to lead and had roots in Texas. He won, and after Barton reached Washington, he stayed. Barton rose to chair the powerful House Energy and Commerce Committee, which had long been the domain of Democratic Representative John Dingell of Michigan. Barton and Dingell swapped gavels as Republicans and Democrats traded control of the House. In the majority and the minority, Barton fashioned a reputation as the leading expert on oil and gas issues in the House Republican caucus. He was a passionate believer in markets, but occasionally, too, a dealmaker who could find legislative compromises with Dingell, who fiercely protected in Congress the interests of automakers and other industrial corporations in Michigan.